And the second case for argument this morning is number 2004-1417, Catherine Hardy versus Delaware County Board of Revision and the Board of Education of the Delaware City School District. And we have for the appellant, Mr. Ricketts.
Good morning, Your Honor. Richard Ricketts on behalf of the appellants, and at this point I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time if I could.
That'd be fine.
May it please the court, the issues before us this morning are not complicated and specifically deal with whether 5 parcels of property in Delaware County qualified for current agricultural use valuation, CAUV for short, for the year 2002. By way of overview, the real jux of this case boils down to 2 issues, one substantive and one procedural. The substantive issue is this: if a property is properly enrolled in a certain governmental farm program, in this instance, the Production Flexibility Program, or PFC, and the Market Assistance Program, does it qualify for CAUV, notwithstanding the fact that it may not be actively being farmed for cropping? The procedural issue are the deadlines and requirements which are set forth in the revised code mandatory, or may a county auditor avoid those requirements under some circumstances? And if so, are those circumstances present in this particular case?
Counsel, I have a question. Did your clients file a renewal application for CAUV status for 2002?
Yes, they did. It was timely filed.
Where is that in the record? I can't find it.
It should be in the underlying Board of Revisions set of documents. However, there has never been a dispute that the application was in fact timely filed. In fact, the actual issue in this case and the letter that was sent, albeit not timely, by the auditor says that the application has been reviewed and is being denied. And so as we look at the procedural aspects of
this case. What document says that?
That would be the letter that was sent
by the allegedly untimely letter?
That is correct. And that is marked as 83 in the exhibits that were filed in the supplemental brief.
That doesn't make any reference to an application being filed, does it? It says we reviewed conducted a review of the real estate and we've inspected it.
I would agree with you that the text of that language does not particularly say that. But there has never been a factual dispute in this case that, in fact, a renewal application was timely submitted. That was never an issue before the court or challenged.
It's not part of the record, because I've looked at every page, and it's not in your supplement.
Your
2003 application is in there.
It certainly would be referenced in the Board of Revisions transcript, which is a part of the record. In terms of going before the Board of Revisions, it was discussed during that particular hearing that, in fact, the issue that was before the court was not whether or not the property had been converted. The issue was whether or not the renewal application had properly been received by the auditor in terms of his viewing of that application.
So that was discussed at the hearing?
That's correct.
All right. I'll look at that again.
The procedural issue that was before the Board of Tax Appeals was in fact the issue of whether or not the letter had been timely forwarded by the auditor. Now, in reviewing this case, and I would note that the Board of Revisions and the Board of Tax Appeals were consistent in indicating that the property did not properly qualify for CAUV. But in reviewing this case, it is slightly different than most CAUV cases that come before the Board of Tax Appeals in what is not being disputed. First of all, no one disputes that prior to 2002, these properties had regularly been enrolled and participated in the CAUV program without any challenge by the Delaware County Auditor. No one disputes that during those periods of time, the property was not being actively farmed, as it had not been actively farmed for a significant period of time. No one disputes that this is a non-renewal case, except maybe Your Honor, And that is the first time that I have ever heard it referenced that this was potentially a non-renewal case.
When you submit your renewal application, do you give them the paperwork that shows, hey, if you go and look at my property, it's going to look like I'm not farming it, but here's why it's still in CAUB status? What do they get?
That's actually one of the issues that is addressed by this particular appeal, in that the application or renewal application simply says, it identifies the partials and says, do they continue to qualify for CAUV? Please sign. And obviously I'm paraphrasing the form, but it does not provide any recitation of whether or not there is active farming on the property. It in essence says, is it more or less than 10 acres? Obviously if it's less than 10 acres, there are additional requirements that the applicant must meet. But if it's more than 10 acres, the recitation simply is an assertion by the property owner that the property still qualifies for the CAUV program.
Would you be able to append some sort of explanation, or that just isn't done in the field?
It is not done in the field. Now, I would note that there are times when people do append things. In fact, I personally append things, but the average layman simply signs the form and returns it. One of the issues in this particular appeal is the fact that you do not have to, nor does it ask, are you enrolled in a government program? It simply says, do you qualify for CAUV? If it said, are you actively farming and or are you actively enrolled in a government program, obviously there would be a lot more clarity in terms of where we are in this particular case. That was not the issue here. But this was not a conversion case. This was a non-renewal case. And no one disputes that the notice was not sent for 2 weeks after the date provided for by the revised code, approximately 2 weeks. And no one disputes that the notice was sent by regular mail as opposed to by certified mail as required by the statute. Now, having provided that overview, I want to specifically address the substantive issues, which I think are the most important. And that is this: if a property is enrolled in a federal government program, in this instance a production flexibility program and market assistance program, does it qualify for current agricultural use valuation? In this regard, we need to look at 571330 of the revised code, which sets forth the definitions of land devoted exclusively to agricultural use, which is the prerequisite for ground to qualify for CAUV. And in addition to the logical and normal references to the fact that the property can be actively enrolled in agricultural production, i.e. corn, soybeans, wheat here in Central Ohio, it says, importantly, or were devoted to and qualified for payments or other compensation under a land retirement or conservation program under an agreement with an agency of the federal government.
I think you could add to your list of things that aren't disputed the fact that it need not necessarily be farmed. I didn't think that was disputed. I thought the issue was whether you had proven that in fact in this federal program.
I know. I think, Your Honor, that is exactly disputed, because I think the auditor is taking the position, a strained position, that in fact, in this particular case, the fact that it was not actively farmed is significant. If you look at the Board of Tax Appeals decision and you look at the brief of the appellee, those things are highlighted. They focus on the testimony of Dan Whiting, who testified, yeah, the property is now being actively farmed, but that's really irrelevant to whether it qualified in 2002. And that's the gist of the entire case before the court. In this particular instance, the Board of Tax Appeals was provided with self-authenticated documents, which they did admit into evidence, that showed that the Farm Service Agency, which also is known as the Commodity Credit Corporation, or back in 98 when this farm was originally enrolled, was known as Commodity Credit Corporation, is subject to a contract with the federal government known as a Production Flexibility Contract. Copies of those contracts are a part of the record and reflect, and you can see in the contracts themselves, which are exhibits 139 and 156 in the appendix, they're U.S. Department of Agricultural specified forms, labeled Production Flexibility Contract, and it says, this contract to participate is entered into between the CCC and the undersigned producers. And once you realize that, in fact, these properties were enrolled under this federal government program, you only need to look to see whether or not that qualifies under 5713.30 as a conservation program. Now, if you look simply at the United States Code, specifically 7201, it references that the purpose of the Agricultural Market Transition Act is to authorize the use of binding production flexibility contracts between the United States and agricultural producers to support farming certainty and flexibility while ensuring continued compliance with farm conservation and wetland protection. It continues on, and the requirements of these programs under production flexibility contracts is further enumerated in 7211 of the U.S. Code, and in pertinent part says, authorization for use of production flexibility contracts. Under the terms of a contract, the owner or producer shall agree in exchange for annual contract payments to comply with the applicable conservation requirements under Subtitle B of Title 12 of the Food and Security Act, comply with applicable wetland protection requirements under Subtitle C of Title 12 of the Act.
It seemed to me the BTA's problem was they didn't feel like you'd adequately explained the connection between the paperwork that you presented and the fact that this was the land in question and these parcels were the ones that were in these programs. Can you address that?
Certainly.
And are they supposed to go digging around in these federal statutes and figure this out, or was there enough? Presumably you think there was enough evidence before them on the point, but isn't that the problem? They felt like we need a witness to tie all this paperwork to what he's saying.
Why do you need a witness on a self-authenticating document? Or conversely, when a document is stipulated and goes into evidence, which there is no dispute that these documents are in evidence, the BTA accepted them and admitted them into evidence, do we need a person to testify as to every provision of a 25-page contract? No. We look at the law as attorneys and lawyers and courts to determine what is the meaning of those statutes and contracts. And the applicability are not evidentiary issues. Those are legal issues which were supported by the brief which was submitted to the BTA.
Seemed to me they had some trouble sorting out, because the drawings or the descriptions of the land differed a bit from the auditor's records. Wasn't that part of the problem?
No, that was not their problem. The problem was is they did not look at the documents that were submitted. We're dealing with farm designations that are done by the Farm Service Agency, in this case 2586 and 2587. The maps were a part of the evidence. They were submitted. The maps overview this real estate as 2586 and 2587. It shows the acreage that is involved and shows the farms. The fact that those were the farms as designated by the Farm Service Agency but do not parallel five parcel numbers does not mean that they're not the same partials. In fact, there was no evidence whatsoever that these were not the same partials. It was, in fact, the aerials are submitted in a part of the record which show that these are the same pieces of real estate. Farm Service Agency looks at them as two tracts. The auditor's partial numbers look at them as five tracts. But no, I don't think that there is any credible dispute that this is the same real estate. To look at that and say that would be to say that the Board of Tax Appeals did not look at the evidence in front of them. The evidence was there. Did they misanalyze it? Yes, that is why we're here. They did, in fact, misanalyze the federal government program and, in fact, the issue of this real estate. Now, in terms of summarizing the substantive issue, I'd like to kind of give you a practical assessment, being a farmer by background. I think the Board of Tax Appeals and the auditor in this case have missed the bigger picture of that the legislators understand, and that is agriculture is not just corn, soybeans, and wheat. Agriculture consists of good husbandry of farm ground. Good husbandry can, and in this particular instance, does support the non-use of the ground for farming purposes because we are preserving the character, runoff, erosion, wetlands that exist on this particular property. I think the failure of the auditor and the Board of Tax Appeals here is understanding that, in fact, when you have an enrollment in a government program that is designed to keep something from being productively farmed, That is still agriculture. It is still not a conversion of real estate for purposes of CAUV. Moving to the procedural issues, there's no question that, in fact, the notices under 571332, which would require the first Monday of August, that this notice was not sent in that fashion. Now, it's the position of the Board of Tax Appeals that the auditor's error can be ignored because no prejudice occurred. Now, if you're going to look at that, let's draw some analogies. First of all, if I filed my notice of appeal late by 2 weeks, there is no question that I would not be here today. Would there have been prejudicial error to anybody by my filing it 2 weeks late? No, we still could have had an opportunity to come here and argue, and there would have been no prejudice. But we have rules, and when we have shalls, they're obligatory, they're mandatory. Another example, if you run a red light and no one gets injured,
speaking of red lights, I'll give you a few seconds on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Morning. Ms. Hager.
Yes.
For the appellee.
Thank you. Jackie Hager on behalf of the Board of Education, Delaware City Schools. May it please the court. Yes, we're looking at a CUV piece of property. Yes, we're looking at the statute that applies, and there are separate qualifications, whether it's being farmed or if it qualifies for a federal conservation or retirement program. The problem in this case arises is that the evidence that was submitted at the BOR and as well as the BTA did not supply enough evidence to the Board of Revision or the Board of Tax Appeals to draw a conclusion that it did in fact qualify under this federal retirement program.
So I take it you're not disputing that fallow land could sometimes qualify for CAUV status.
That's correct. I mean, the statute provides that either land that is being farmed can lay fallow for 1 year and then continue to be farmed after that, or that land that is not necessarily being farmed but does qualify under a federal retirement conservation program. Those are the two different, well, there's a few other types, but those are the two main issues that we're dealing with here today. It's interesting that appellant just stated that the issue of whether or not the property was actually being farmed was irrelevant, and that we basically spent a lot of time on our brief on that issue. Well, we spent some time on our brief on that issue mainly because the only evidence that was admitted at the Board of Tax Appeals was the testimony of a farmer stating that it was now being farmed.
How is it supposed to work? How does it work, or doesn't it work at the county level? If you have this situation and this form doesn't give an opportunity for the unrepresented property owner to explain what's going on, how is the auditor to know what to do if they're conducting these inspections?
The auditor obviously does send out the renewal forms on a yearly basis, and the property owners fill out the forms. It's an affidavit type thing they sign saying, yes, it's still being used for current agricultural use valuation issues type of things. At that point, then the auditor does send out a notice saying, okay, we don't feel that it is being used and we're going to remove it. The property owner then has the opportunity to send any sort of letter or make a phone call or any sort of objection or rebuttal to that saying, yes, it does qualify, or here, this is why it qualifies. The property owner never made any kind of comment or sent a letter to the auditor at that point in time. Then later on, the auditor, in fact, does remove it from the CUV program, which kicks in this 3 years of recoupment taxes and put back on the regular tax list rather than on the CUV tax list. Although the form does not state, you know, there is not a separate check mark to say that it qualifies based on a federal conservation program, none of the forms that I've seen in any of the counties, it's a standard form that all the counties use, none of those forms, there's not that I've seen, again, I'm not saying that there isn't, but of all the forms I've seen in all the different counties, they all seem to be the standard same form, and there is no separate qualification check mark for that. It's just whether or not the property owner, under their own oath of signing this document for renewal, believes that the property is still qualifying for CUV status. At that point in time, the auditor is empowered at any time to go and review and inspect properties for valuation purposes or for determining whether or not it's being qualified for CUV purposes. The auditor inspected this property, did not believe it qualified for CUV purposes for whatever purpose, for whatever reason, and removed it at that point in time. Sent out a notice letter, property owner did not state otherwise, and that's why we're here today.
Did you have any insights for me on this issue of whether a renewal application was actually filed for 2002?
To my knowledge, yes, there was a renewal application filed. I do not believe it is in the Board of Revision transcript, though. I reviewed it just last night, and I did not recall seeing it anywhere in there. But I do know that the previous auditor, David Yost, who is now the prosecutor and was the prosecutor at this time at the Board of Revision, was called in to testify, and I don't believe there was brought up any question as to whether or not the renewal form had been filed. So at this point, I would be fine to stipulate to the fact that there was a renewal application filed for 2002 tax year, although I have not personally necessarily seen it, and it may not very well be a part of the record.
Was there any explanation as to why the letter was sent regular mail and why it was late?
No, there's not. And at one point in time, there was some issue as to whether or not this was a conversion case or not. And if it was being argued that it was a conversion case, then 5713.32 does not apply.
Right.
And instead, it's 5713.35, yeah, which allows to the
late.
First week of September.
Right.
So therefore, it would be within time.
Right.
I don't know if that was part of the issue as to why there was some question whether or not it was not sent, you know, by August, the first Monday in August or not.
Those later notices go out by regular mail, typically?
Yes, the regular notices would go out by regular mail. So, and I think the court is correct in your presumption that it appears that the Board of Tax Appeals wasn't necessarily saying that this property has to be farmed in order to qualify for CUV, but that there wasn't enough evidence before it to draw an analogy that or conclusion that it was, in fact, enrolled in this sort of program. The Board of Tax Appeals even said in its decision that, one, the evidence that was before it, these contracts, they were only portions of the contracts. They were not complete contracts. Some of the documents that are that were admitted as evidence over, unlike what was stated previously, were not by stipulation, were admitted over our objection, the Board of Education objection of the Board of Tax Appeals. Some of those exhibits that were admitted were not complete copies. They were not even signed, so they weren't the final copies. They weren't signed documents. Again, not for all of them, but for some of the documents that were submitted as evidence to support this theory that it qualified under a federal program for retirement property, they appear to be somewhat just generated printout screens, and were not signed. The issue whether or not they're self-authenticating documents, you know, we can get into the rules of evidence on that. We are the belief that they have to be certified or under some sort of seal in order to be considered to be self-authenticating documents. They were not in these cases. There was a letter that accompanied one of the sets of documents stating from the Delaware, I think the Delaware Farm Agency Division, stating that these were copies that they had submitted to at the property owner's request, but nothing that came from the actual federal retirement program that was alleged to be enrolled, that the property was enrolled in.
Have you been involved in other cases like this? I mean, is this typical that these documents are just presented with no testimony? Or?
See, that's the problem. Whenever I've been involved in a CUV case, again, I haven't been involved in hundreds of them, but whenever there is a CUV case involved, the property owner always is very willing to come in. They testify as to their intent with the property, whether they are farming it, whether it is enrolled in a retirement program, and what they intend to do with the property in the future, what their intent was to do it when they acquired the property, and then as far as a retirement program, what they did had to do to qualify, what type of program they're actually enrolled in, what they have to do yearly to reapply, what they do to make sure that they qualify for that, the funds that they receive, how the funds are attributed or compensated, what the funds are used for, or how those funds are determined, what the fund amount is determined. And none of that was in this case. None of this was presented. The only time there was any testimony other than from the farmer, who wasn't even hired until August of 2003, so he wasn't even farming the land, and he even testified that the land hadn't been farmed in 2002. The only other testimony that we heard was at the Board of Revision from Mr. Ricketts himself, who was sworn in to testify as to the documents. Again, we don't have a property owner coming in to testify, and I think that's the main point. The Board of Tax Appeals wasn't saying necessarily that because it's not farmed or laying fallow that it doesn't qualify, but that you're claiming that it qualifies under this exception of being in a federal retirement program which you have not presented evidence or enough evidence to support that. The parcel numbers, there's five parcels in the subject property. However, what the federal program or the documents that they did supply shows two farm numbers. The acreage doesn't match up exactly. And again, these documents, some of them aren't signed, some of them appear to be just printouts, so they don't even appear to be possible final copies since they're not signed. So I think that's a big hurdle. As far as this notice requirement that we touched upon earlier, whether or not it's conversion or what it may be, which statute applies is one of the issues, but also, even if it is 5713.32 that does apply, and even if the notice that got sent out was untimely, in the court's eyes. The Board of Tax Appeals even cited Rocky Fort Hunt Country Club versus Testa and stated that the whole purpose was that they were not prejudiced, the property owner was not prejudiced because they were afforded the opportunity to object, to file a complaint, which is how we are here today.
Draw for me the distinction that the appellant did on, say, a notice of appeal. Why would that be different in your view?
As far as a notice of appeal being, it's based on the conservation program?
No. The fact that a notice of appeal, a failure to file untimely, would be a jurisdictional defect, whereas you're saying this late letter was not. What's the difference?
Well, the late letter is not a jurisdictional defect because they're still afforded the opportunity to file a complaint. The deadline for filing a complaint isn't until March of the following year, March 31st. They had more than ample time. And when you look at it as far as if it is a conversion case, they wouldn't have got the notice for conversion until September anyways, which again, they still have plenty of time. They got it in August. They still have plenty of time to file, because in conversion cases, the notices don't go out until in September, and the court, you know, statutorily still finds that from September until the following March is ample time for them to prepare a single one-page objection to the valuation or removal of CUV. I don't think that, as the BTA stated, that they were prejudiced, because we are here today. We're arguing that they've had ample opportunity to argue at the Board of Vision, at the Board of Tax Appeals, and now before this honorable court. However, they haven't taken upon themselves, in light of this being a big case for them, to bring in the owner to testify as to how it qualified for this program, the nature of the program, and the specifics and details that the Board of Vision and the Board of Tax Appeals and now this court was looking for in order to make an informed decision. We simply don't have the information that it needs, the court needs, to make that decision, because it was never supplied. Again, the only evidence that was admitted at the Board of Tax Appeals was a testimony of a farmer coming in and saying, it wasn't farmed in 2002, I started farming in 2003. If they were so concerned with this issue of federal retirement program, why didn't they bring someone in to testify that? They had introduced no new evidence on that issue. Instead, they introduced evidence on a completely unrelated issue in their eyes and in mine in this case, that it's now being farmed.
You said Mr. Ricketts was sworn in as a witness?
Is that of any significance? At the Board of Vision, I mean.
Oh, at the Board of Revision.
At the first court. At the Board of Vision, I mean. Yeah, there would be an issue of whether or not there's a conflict in my eyes, but.
I was thinking in terms of that he was a witness before the BTA to present the information, but I see what you're saying. It was at the Board of Revision.
Right, he was a witness at the Board of Revision to submit the evidence. However, he was not able, when Mr. Yost, the prosecutor, was brought down, there was some breaks during the hearing. Once the Delaware County prosecutor, David Yost, was brought down to inquire of the witness on behalf of representing the auditor and the Board of Revision, Mr. Ricketts wasn't able to answer certain questions, obviously, that the board needed to answers to in order to make an informed decision. They asked about the specifics of the program. They asked about the amount of money that was received. And Mr. Yost even stated that just because, you know, there's some documentation that some money was received by the property owner from a federal agency, that doesn't directly show what program it was tied to. I don't know if I need to stop yet or not.
You have two more minutes if you'd like.
So I think there was just some issues that the property owner should have came and been able to answer some of the questions, because the evidence that's submitted doesn't directly tie to the specific property. There is some, you know, leaps that you can make to fill in any gaps of conclusions, But in this type of situation, do you really want to make those guesstimates in order to fill in any gaps? You want to have certainties in this case. And the certainties that are in this case is that Mr. Ricketts testified at the Board of Vision stating that this land had been fallowed and not been farmed for 5 years, that it allegedly qualified for a Federal Reserve program, but we don't have documentation, and the documentation that we do have is not complete. It's portions of contracts, it's unsigned documents. There's not even copies of checks as to what was actually received, which was one of the arguments that David Yost made at the Board of Vision, stating, do you have copies of the checks? Have you seen the checks? Mr. Ricketts was unable to answer those questions, which is why I thought it was so important, and based on their appeal, that they would want to bring in the property owner to testify, and instead they just brought in a farmer who wasn't even employed until August of 2003, way beyond the year that we're looking at of January 1, 2002.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Ricketts, your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly, in terms of the issue of whether or not a CAU application was filed, I would note page 19 of the transcript, that is 19 of the supplement that we filed. Also, I believe that the opposing counsel has stipulated that, in fact, one was filed. In terms of the evidentiary issues, I really want to quickly point out that evidence is evidence. You do not need a witness to have evidence. We have trials that consist of stipulating of documents and moving forward with the interpretation of those by the court. All of the documents that were available from the Farm Service Agency were provided under cover letter, were authenticated, and submitted into evidence. Included within that was two production flexibility contracts. Included with that, and that was evidence of the payments by electronic transfer. So obviously there would be no hard checks given EFT transfers. The evidence substantiates there was a production flexibility contract and that those do qualify. It was the legal briefs that clearly set forth that, in fact, that qualification existed.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case will be submitted to the court for a decision.